Good afternoon. The recording, this particular recording, is courtesy of Rudy Lee, who had some problems in recording it, but got most of the session, whereas my machine stopped working altogether, and I got none of it. So there's a few interruptions in here, but the bulk of the session is successfully recorded, and I hope you enjoy.
Copies in circulation that I'm aware of. Whereas the material in regular type is basically the urtext, and for the most part, the urtext and the notes are identical, or very, very close to each other. So I've used italics to distinguish phonologically, and that is marked in italics. Okay, now, the other thing about the next paragraph, we ended with this, we spent quite a bit of time on this theme, how Jesus is stressing to Helen that he's willing to help with all minutiae, all things that don't matter, all the little trivial things that we have to do every day. He is willing to basically direct or control those things if we let him, because they don't matter. And we're wasting our time and our effort. We're wasting our will in worrying about such things as what to wear. Or this paragraph, Helen has got that. And the issue of what to wear is addressed, and I'll let Deborah read this. T1B22DN29 here. It's a lovely little two-sentence paragraph.
Go and look up atonement, and then get dressed. To save time, wear exactly what I tell you, and go. 22DN30. Atonement, obsolete, short for to set at one or reconcile, to agree. Obviously, before reconciliation or agreement is possible, the discordant or out of accord must be undone. It may seem as if darkness must be dispelled before light can come in, but the truth is that darkness is dispelled by light. 22D and 31. Doug, here's the mic.
Okay, that's obviously the dictionary definition that Helen is abridging there. The obsolete definition is to set at one, or at least what the dictionary says is an obsolete definition, to set at one or reconcile to agree. And obsolete here is actually really interesting because the word atonement really is at one-ment. It was coined by William Tyndale in 1527 when he was translating the Greek New Testament into English, and he couldn't find an English word that meant what he understood the Greek term to mean, so he coined one. And it was meant to mean to set at one or reconcile or restore, restore. Is the key concept there in what the word atonement has come to mean and taken on connotations of paying for sin. The criminal must atone for his sin, for his crime, and pay a debt. So atonement has taken on these guilt and guilt expiation connotations, when in fact originally there's nothing specifically about guilt at all. It's simply to restore any kind of brokenness, to repair any kind of damaged relationship, to essentially recognize, to come to the point of recognition of the inherent oneness of us all as brothers and children of one Father. And the other emphasis in here that I would like to draw attention to is the notion of undoing. Jesus is stressing the idea that before reconciliation or agreement is possible, the discordant or out of accord must be undone. And as anyone familiar with the Course knows, a great deal of the emphasis in the first half of the workbook and the early chapters is about the undoing a thought system that creates discord, that believes that sin and guilt are real. In the undoing of that, space is made for the redoing, the retraining of our minds to a truer, more correct understanding of the universe. And then that last line, which is really kind of cool, it may seem as if darkness must be dispelled before light can come in, but in fact, the truth is, the darkness is dispelled by light. You can't dispel darkness except by light. Okay. And now we're moving into some of Helen's own, basically, diary entries, her commentary on her experience as this material is coming to her. And this brings us to T1B, 22D, and 31. Here you go, Deborah.
Last night I was planning to type up the course for you, but was strictly ordered not to go back to it before I got over Wally. 22D, N32. It seems that the course has a lot of answers and carries a lot of very high point credits. But as you always say, you have to know the questions first. 22D, N33. Really, it's addressed to Bill Thetford. That's who she's talking to. Well, just that part where the asterisk was, Doug? Oh, here's the mic.
A lot of these comments that Helen's making, when the writing moves into Helen's voice, and it's no longer Jesus speaking but Helen, she is actually talking to or writing to Bill. Sometimes she's writing to Jesus, but much of the time she's writing to Bill because she knows that she's going to be reading this material to Bill in a day or two for him to type up, and she's making a note essentially to herself to tell Bill this. And so she was going to type up the course for you, Bill, but was ordered not to. So this is telling us also that sometimes she dictated the material and Bill typed it up, and sometimes she typed it up herself. And in this instance, she was planning to do that, but didn't. And then she goes on, and again, she's addressing Bill and telling Bill the story of her evening that she's planning to do, that she will be sharing with him in a day or so. And this takes us to T1B, 22D, and 32.
Thank you. That's new information to me. So it seems that the course, I just read this little paragraph, but I'll read it again. It seems that the course has a lot of answers and carries a lot of very high point credits. But as you always say, you have to know the questions. This morning I did ask for help with Wally. The answer seems to lie in point 6 and 7. That's why he gave me the chalice for Wally. It belongs to him, but he didn't find it. 22, Doug, here you go.
Okay, again we have an instance of point 4. In point 6 and 7, that, I believe, refers to the material where we started last week, which would be T1B6 and T1B7, the discussion of Wally's chalice and Bill's list. And that reminds me of something I meant to mention. Last week I was saying I don't know what Bill's list is. And this week, some material actually written by Bill at exactly this time, commenting on exactly that segment, has come to my attention. And it includes a list that Bill wrote up of people he felt the Holy Spirit wanted him to have issues with, again, in his life. And he made a list of individuals with whom he had relationships that needed some. Helen was then asking, is Wally on the list? And I, in this context.
Congratulations, you won.
And he here, I think, is Jesus. So Helen's telling Bill, that's why he, Jesus, gave me the chalice for Wally. And I still don't know exactly what Helen meant by the use of that word. Chalice is a container of holiness, wine, holy water, something holy, but exactly what the connotation is here that Helen understood, I'm not sure. And the chalice, whatever this was, properly belonged to Wally, but he didn't find it. Anyways. Okay, back to you, Deborah.
Him and not get bogged down. I consent to stay with her unconscious. Here you go, Doug.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right, Deborah. And we know note here something that's very typical in the notes and even somewhere between Helen and Jesus. There's a conversation sometimes going on, and in paragraph 35, tell Bill it doesn't matter that he didn't remember the dream with, that's Jesus speaking, I believe. I don't think Helen's telling herself, tell Bill. And she knew what the dream was, so she didn't write it down. And I'm sure when she spoke those words to Bill, she finished the sentence. But it's not recorded here. And then I think it's Helen's voice back in paragraph 36, where she's saying to Bill, leave everything to him, Jesus. My feelings regarding Gary, Art, etc., all of which I can simply refer to him and not get bogged down. She's learning, and she's basically making a note that she's figured this out. She's understood the teaching we were talking about last week about leaving to Christ control issues that you don't need to worry about. This is the real secret of not wasting energy or time. And then, yes, that beautiful line, I asked him to stay with my unconscious while I slept and just passed out. Wow. And yes, as Deborah has just typed, the paragraph coding here uses the volume, chapter, section, for paragraphs inserted from the notes. In this case, we had 37 paragraphs inserted, a huge insertion. There's very few that are of that magnitude. And now, as you see, the type returns to regular. We're back to the Urtex material, where the notes in the Urtex pretty much correspond. 2E, Deborah.
Corrections regarding point 21 cobwebs of iron. This is upside down as stated. The part about uniting human frailty with the strength of God is all right, but the explanation stops too soon. If iron is themes, because cobwebs are associated with the frailty and iron with strength.
And here we have a further explanation in the next paragraph of why this change is being asked for. Hello, Christian. Christian just typed on the board. Hi, Doug. So we're at P1B22F in the Urtext here. Deborah.
The raw material, or iron, is heavy but crude. And stands for the body, which is a crude creation, be regarded, in effect, as an airy and temporary home which can just be blown away with a slight breeze. 22G, the awareness that the spirit, and not the body, is the altar of truth. This is the recognition that leads to the healing power of the miracle. 22H, a miracle rearranges the order of perception and places the level in their true perspective. This heals at all levels, because all sickness comes from confusing the levels. This is really wonderful here.
Yeah, I just want to emphasize that point. In the first part there that's critical is that spirit and not the body is the altar of truth. That is the recognition that leads to the healing power of the miracle. The altar of truth, which is symbolic for causation. And then we get into miracle rearranges the order of perception and places all the levels of perception in their true perspective. And by that, means it places the spiritual level of perception, the Holy Spirit's correct from Helen, and I'm going to give you back.
Well, confusion, then our mind goes into conflict, and if we're in conflict, we understand that. I think that's really, really dynamo. Just relating to it in on that level of level confusion. 22H N1. This is in parentheses. I must be getting confused myself. I repeated this myself backward, corrected as per 22I in parentheses. Tell Bill about the idea. And in closed parentheses inside, which is still dim to Helen Schuckman, that the reason is not that you, in parentheses plural, distantiate, doubt, or cannot believe. It is more of a reaction formation against a pull which you both recognize is so intense that you are afraid that you will be uprooted. But remember that a cobweb is really stronger than the iron. If you see it, For some reason, I've got a page mixed up. Okay. If you see it is reversed, parentheses, one point already tells you that the miracles reverse the physical or lower order laws, close parentheses. 22.
There you go. I think I'm in the wrong spot there.
In parentheses. Yeah. Tell Bill about the idea.
Figured out.
And in closed parentheses inside.
Your page break
which
there,
is still dim to Helen Schuckman.
Would be T1,
that the reason is not that you. It is more of a reaction formation against a pull which you both recognize is so intense that you are afraid that you will be uprooted. Remember that a cobweb is really stronger than the iron. If you see it, For some reason, I've got a page mixed up. Okay. If you see it is reversed, parentheses, one point already tells you that the miracles reverse the physical or lower order. True witness for God. You have every right to examine my credentials. In fact, I urge you to do so. You haven't read the Bible in years. Here you go, Doug.
Okay, I'm just trying to look something up here. You haven't read the Bible in years, and implicit in that is go read the Bible. And Jesus is frequently quoting the Bible and reminding Helen of things she knows about the Bible and offering explanations. And he's saying here, you have every right to examine my credentials. In fact, I urge you to do so. Who are you? Where is this coming from? Well, examine the credentials. And what credentials are those? Once again, Jesus is clearly the author, the voice, is clearly identifying himself as Jesus of Nazareth. In case anybody had any doubts about who this was talking. Here's a comment on the board. Jesus once built a scribe. Yes, well, there's a lot of nuance on that topic in this material. And we find a couple of comments that I think explain it or offer some insight into what's going on here. Bill had difficulty getting the voice himself. And this is discussed at several points, and Jesus even explains why that's the case. He describes the course as Bill's course. He assigns Helen the role of helping Bill, to which Helen kicks up a terrible fuss and resents greatly this idea that she should help Bill, insisting that Bill should help her. But Jesus is saying, no, Helen, you need to help Bill get these words down. And that is her assigned function in this scribing process, which makes them both scribes, undertaking a function that neither can complete alone. They need each other. It's a collaborative effort. Bill can't get the words straight without Helen, but Helen can't cope with the material at all without Bill holding her hand, as she often later was to say. All right. Yeah, you haven't read the Bible in years. Okay, this takes us to P1B22R. Deborah.
Special explanatory note. As soon as you, in parentheses, Helen and Bill, have entered the second phase, you will not only be willing to enter into communion, but will also understand peace and joy. Your commitment is not yet total. That is why you still have more to learn than to teach. When your equilibrium stabilizes, you can teach as much as you learn. This will give you the proper sense of balance. Meanwhile, remember that no effort is wasted. Unless you remember this, you cannot avail yourself of my efforts, which are limitless. Here you go, Doug.
One of the things that becomes completely clear in this material, that's not clear in later, not nearly so clear in later abridged versions, is that Helen and Bill are having a lot of difficulty with this material. We are still in the first few weeks of the dictation. They have no idea what's coming. And they're still somewhat shocked by the whole experience. The first-time reader of A Course in Miracles frequently has a similar experience. What is this stuff? To the extent that the message comes through at all, many people experience the same kind of upset and disequilibrium that Helen and Bill are experiencing, because it's essentially telling them that their entire worldview, the entire ego structure, is bogus, and it needs to be undone. And that normally causes at least a little bit of disquiet, if not outright fear. In seeing how Helen and Bill respond with fear and anxiety to exactly those propositions as they're presented, and seeing how Jesus helps them through it, many people have been able to very much identify with Helen and Bill's experience, and it helps them through this first introduction to some of the basic ideas that the Course will go on to explain in great detail, including the idea that your whole worldview has to be undone, and it doesn't work the way you think it works, and you need to come here with willingness. And seeing Helen and Bill work through this, has been a source of great encouragement for a great many first-time course students. For those who are already fairly familiar with the basic ideas of the course, this may seem almost like kindergarten to a university graduate. But this bridge material also fills in details that can be helpful to many of us. So that brings us to 22S. Here you go, Deborah.
I wanted to remark on 22R here, because it really was grabbing me when I read it earlier today, and it just grabbed me again. And it's this whole idea of the equilibrium, our equilibrium of what we're taking in, what we're learning, stabilizing. So this is speaking strongly to me that before I am teaching, that I need to have that balance with inside myself and need to have maybe more so in touch with that inner guidance so that I'm not teaching ego and I am teaching what Holy Spirit or Jesus is requesting me to teach and filling my part of what they want me to fulfill. So how is that? That's where I get out of this. So do you have any comment on that, Doug? I just wanted to see if I'm off or on here. Here you go.
Well, thanks for stressing that equilibrium issue. And there is a strong message in 22R. And first of all, we're told about phases. First and second phase are mentioned. And Helen and Bill are still in the first phase, which is basically introductory, where they're presented with a thought system that's entirely alien to what they already believe, and some undoing is needed. And there's a lot of talk about undoing in the course and in this first chapter. In the second phase, you will not only be willing to enter into communion. So first off, we're basically being told they're not willing to enter into communion yet, but that will come. And also, you will understand peace and joy, which by implication means they don't understand it right now. And then there's a kind of a but. Your commitment is not yet total. Because your commitment is not yet total, you still have more to learn than to teach. When your equilibrium stabilizes, and this refers to the whole fear and disequilibrium problem that arises when anybody's belief system is confronted by something highly contradictory to it. You're told that what you think is true isn't. There is at least disequilibrium, often fear. But when it stabilizes, when you regain equilibrium with this new information, then you can teach as much as you learn. And this will give you the proper sense of balance. And it also implies, if we look at what's being said there, that teaching what you learn, teaching as much as you learn, is required for the proper sense of balance. That A Course in Miracles is not only for the student to learn, but for the student to share. And later on, as you know, we're taught, or as many of you will know, we're taught that we all teach all the time. And the question is, what are we teaching? And if we're teaching the ego, we're not helping anybody. If we're teaching to, that we're relating to at every level, we're helping ourselves. Inasmuch, there's that quote, there's that idea again, inasmuch as, where is it? You do it unto the least of these my brethren, you do it unto yourself and me. And this applies very much to teaching, because teaching refers to everything we do in every relationship with everyone we undertake. We are always doing unto, demonstrating who we are, what we believe, in our tone of voice, in our communications, in the ideas we respond to, in the way we treat other people. And that can refer as much to a husband or wife as it can refer to the cashier in the store. These are human beings. These are our brothers. and they pick up something from us in every point of contact we have with them. And in that sense, we are teaching at all times. Yeah, that is a very potent paragraph. And then a reminder that no effort is wasted. Even if you don't see the effects, no effort is wasted. Everything, every inch of commitment and willingness you bring into your life has a positive effect, even if you don't see it in the short term. And unless you remember this, you cannot avail yourself of my efforts, Jesus said, which are limitless. Now that is really a stunning statement. That we must remember that no effort is wasted. Otherwise, we cannot avail ourselves of his efforts, which are limitless. In other words, even if we can't see, as I understand this and apply this, even if we can't see any reason to be nice to that guy or any benefit to him or myself, the effort of behaving lovingly is not wasted, and the remembrance of that avails Jesus' efforts or opens the door to Jesus' efforts. It's that act that is actually the willingness, the expression of willingness to allow the Holy Spirit or Jesus to introduce the miraculous into the situation. We become a conduit when we remember that no effort is wasted, quite aside from whether we can see any effect of that effort in the instant. Christian writes, could you repeat, when you reach a certain point, you then teach as much as you learn. When your equilibrium stabilizes, this is T1B22R, when your equilibrium stabilizes, you can teach as much as you learn. This will give you the proper sense of balance, which implies that without teaching as much as you learn, you're still going to be in disequilibrium. That the teaching what you learn, as you learn it, the sharing of the learning with everyone around you, with everyone with whom you come into contact, is crucial for the maintenance or establishment of a proper sense of balance. Okay, have we got that? And by the way, if anyone wants to make a comment or share something with regard to this material, stick your hand up. Comments are welcome. Not sure about the word equilibrium, really. Well, the context in which I understand it, Christian, is that as the Course introduces to the first-time reader, and remember, for Helen and Bill, they're in their first couple of weeks with the Course here still. This is all new to them. They have no idea what's going on. What tends to happen it's called cognitive dissonance in psychology. When you encounter information that contradicts what you think you know in any field of activity, it clashes with what you know. It creates a disequilibrium, a sense of vertigo even. Some people actually get physically dizzy when they're presented with information they can't believe because it contradicts what they think they know. Or what they already believe. And that disequilibrium is really chronic to first-time Course students. If they don't react with total hostility and throw the book away, as they receive and understand the ideas that are newly being presented to them for the first time, those ideas contradict things they think they believe, and a certain sense of instability, disequilibrium arises. And certainly Helen and Bill are experiencing this in spades, as we see in the notes in the Urtext material, where their own fears and anxieties about what they're hearing are very clearly expressed, and Jesus addresses those in very reassuring terms, but also carefully explaining, as in this paragraph, what's going on and where it's going to lead them to. Instability about the directions of the Course Christian rights. No. Because for Helen and Bill and the first time reader of the course, there's no idea about where the course is going. They don't know. They haven't read it yet. They haven't heard it. They don't know where it's going. What they know is that they've already been told a few things about miracles, a few things about love, and a few things about perception, which contradict what they think they know and what they believe already. And that can lead to two results. You say, that can't be true because it doesn't agree with what I think, so you put the book away and that's it. Or, as in the case of Helen and Bill and those who go on to become course students, there's enough resonance in what you're hearing that you think it might be true, even though it doesn't agree with what you currently believe, that you keep going. But just in the very idea of entertaining the possibility of the truth of information which is contradictory to what you already believe causes emotional imbalance. It's shocking. It's stressful. It's like, well, what's true? If that's not true, and this is true, and it creates a disequilibrium, which needs to stabilize before you can teach, and yet in the teaching of what you learn, the proper sense of balance arises. So stability, balance, equilibrium, balance, these are all closely related terms. Trust in Jesus will develop, yes, over time. Initially, what tends to happen is a certain amount of confusion. People look at this whole new set of data that completely disagrees with what they already think they know, and there's confusion, like, and fear in many cases. I mean, it's sometimes more than just a little dizziness. It's actually they're afraid of what this might mean in their lives. And certainly this is the case with Helen and Bill, and they both talk about it. And Bill was to talk about it later in some detail, that he realized that what he was hearing in these first weeks meant that everything or a great deal of what he devoted his life to was meaningless. And that idea wasn't terribly welcome to him. He found it very unsettling. Yet he also, at some level, knew it was true, and so proceeded with the material. And that I would call disequilibrium, that recognition that, you know, good grief, if that is so, then everything I've been doing for the last 30 years was a waste of time. And everything I think I know and value and believe in isn't quite so. That's disequilibrium. You remember thinking you couldn't do without anger. well, ever tried it? All right. Deborah, back to you and T1B22S.
That touches on the belief that I had back when I believed that my anger was justified, Christians. That's really neat. What you just posted there about the anger. 22S, have a good day, is in parentheses. Since only eternity is real, why not use the illusion of time constructively? You might remember that underneath all the everlasting arms. I read that little piece again. You might remember that underneath are the everlasting arms. 22S-N1, a little blurb of notes. Ask Bill's help for guidance about the flu shots, but be sure to tell him not to let fear enter in the consideration. Doug, here's the mic.
This quote from the Bible, Deuteronomy, I think, about the everlasting arms is when Helen comes back to a number of times, and it seems to have considerable significance for her, that she recognizes from this concept that should she fall, the everlasting arms are there to catch her. And from that concept, she takes great comfort. And in this sort of casual comment, Jesus is saying, have a good day. and then goes into a philosophical level of, since only eternity is real, why not use the illusion of time, the day, constructively? And then this note of reassurance goes the everlasting arms, because should you fail, I'm here to catch you. And then this little bit from the notes about the flu shots, and Helen is being told to ask Bill's help for guidance about the flu shots. And be sure to tell him not to let fear enter into the consideration. I'm not sure exactly what was going on with Bill and the flu shots, but it comes up here a number of times. And there was some issue Bill was having about flu shots, and eventually it is peaceably resolved. Okay. T1B22T, Deborah.
Biblical quotation. If you are ashamed of me before men, I will be ashamed of you before God. Parentheses. Helen Schuckman, question of misquote, close parentheses, is interpreted as a threat only as long as you remain in the first step. Parentheses, this is in parentheses, see bottom of page 6 for steps. 22U. What it really means is that if you are ashamed of me, in parentheses, or embarrassed by love, you will project and therefore make it impossible for me to reach you. Make every effort you can not to do this. I will help you as much as you will let me. 22U-N1 into notes. Note regarding Wally. Your intense reaction to him involves both denial and projection. Wally's chief weakness is mockery, which he utilizes because he is embarrassed by love. He does not yet have your own strong counter component, which has made you able to sustain a great amount of intense but unnecessary conflict. You hate him because his solutions remind you of your own troubles, which become magnified by this kind of defense. 22U-N2. The way to shift from defense to protection is to recognize what is really happening to both of you and correct it. His strength will then be yours, and yours will be his. This is what is meant by the strength of miracles. Doug, here's the mic.
Wow, that's an amazing little bit of prose there. I'm going to respond to the question on the board about, was Jesus familiar with the Bible before the course? In the 28 pages of her shorthand notebook, which is mostly a diary at that point, that occurred before October 21st, 1965, with the beginning of the course, Helen quotes the Bible three or four times, undertakes, I think, three different prayers for friends or relatives who were ill, and is clearly not only familiar with the course, I mean the Bible, in terms of being able to write down quotes off by heart, but is very spiritually oriented in terms of being very prayerful, very devoted. Long before she had anything to do with the course, she was baptized in the Baptist Church, I believe, and regularly attended Mass at Catholic Church, and was very interested in the Rosary. The idea commonly presented that she was an atheist at the time that the Course first came to her and had no interest in God, Jesus, or religion is simply not confirmed by the documentary evidence. that shows she was very interested in religious and spiritual issues. And although we're told she hasn't read the Bible for a long time, Jesus tells her that a few page or so up, that implies that she read it at some time, and her familiarity with it in her own writing, both direct quotes and biblical themes, indicates that what she read, at least she retained some significant portion of. And here we have more about Wally, and what is the issue with Wally, and I don't know what was going on with Helen and Wally, or who Wally is. But there was an issue, and the upshot of it was that Helen was getting defensive. She's being advised to shift from defense to protection, and that is just in itself a fascinating combination of words. Since to the ego, protection is defense, but to the spirit, protection is something quite different. And the way to shift is to recognize what is really happening to both of you and correct it. His strengths will then be yours, yours will be his, and this is what is meant by the strength of miracles. So basically, the only protection is love. The only real protection, the only spiritual protection. And in this issue with Wally, I think that's what Helen is being told about. But again, clearly this isn't, never was intended to be, quote, part of the course, unquote. It's Jesus communicating with Helen and Helen communicating with Jesus about a particular relationship that was an issue for her in the moment. Which brings us to T1B 23A, miracles make time and tide wait for all men. All right, and I'll give you the mic, Deborah.
Miracles make time and tide wait for all men. They can heal the sick and raise the dead because man himself made both death and taxes and can abolish both. Excuse me. Note, tax also means strain. Parentheses. One definition for miracle is that which, or one who, is of surpassing excellence or merit. Close parentheses. And parentheses from dictionary, third definition, close parentheses. 23b. That's right, that you are a miracle. God creates only that which, or one who, is of surpassing excellence or merit. Man is capable of this kind of creation, too, being in the image and likeness of his own creator. Anything else is only his own nightmare and does not exist. Only the creations of light are real. Doug, here's the mic. Doug, the mic's open for you.
Oh, sorry, I forgot to pick it up. This is a lovely one. That's right, that you are a miracle. And God creates, quoting from the dictionary, only that which is, or one who, is of surpassing excellence or merit. Man, and that means you and me, are capable of this kind of creation too, being in the image of light and likeness of our own creator. Anything else is only our own nightmare and doesn't really exist. We just made it up. Now there's a question on the board about how the notebooks came to light. Really short history lesson here. In 1981, Helen Schuckman died, February of 1981. Sometime after that, her husband, Louis Schuckman, according to Ken Watnick, this is from Ken Watnick in his book, Absence from Felicity, which is not online, but the book is in print. Ken says that Louis Schuckman asked him to copyright a collection of Helen's unpublished papers. Now, that was actually done in, I think, May of 1990. Ken took, something in the order of 10,000 pages of material to the Copyright Office in Washington, D.C., and filed two copies of it there as per the requirements for a copyright, and then applied for a copyright in his own name, which is really bizarre because, of course, he had no legal right to the material. Now, Louis would have known, being a bookstore operator, that when you copyright something, copies go into the Library of Congress, where they remain forever. So the survival of the material would be ensured by that process, and that the Library of Congress is a public archive. Anybody can go there, anybody who can get there, can, on application, see the material. So he basically made it available to anyone to go and read by that decision to take Helen's material, and it included the shorthand notes, the material that was copyrighted in 1990. That's where it can be found, at the United States Copyright Office Department of the Library of Congress. And because it was copyrighted in Ken's name rather than in any other way that might have been legally valid, that actually makes it public domain, because that's not a valid copyright. I can't copyright something you wrote. Ken can't apply for a copyright on something Helen wrote. And so that material essentially became public domain by virtue of that historical event. And the material in the Library of Congress was eventually copied and turned up on the net in the early 21st century, which is where I came across it and proceeded, with the help of a number of people, to transcribe the handwritten notes and identify where they were different from the Urtext manuscript. In fact, the Urtext manuscript was circulated by Helen, at least in parts, going back to 1965. I think it's the earliest evidence I have of her sharing a copy with someone. And that material showed up on the net in 2000 in a variety of different forms. I think some of it came from the United States Copyright Office. Other material that I believe there were other sources, just by looking at the photocopies that have been posted on the net. They do not appear to all be copies of the Library of Congress material, to my eye, anyway. So it came out through that route. It basically goes back to Louis, Helen's husband, who decided it should be made available in that form, in that way, for whatever his reasons were, and therefore it's available to us. Okay. I should probably write a couple of paragraphs on that and put it on the net somewhere so that when that question is asked, it can be answered, because a lot of people don't know where it came from, and in the absence of knowing, various mythologies have arisen. But that's what happened as far as I know. Now, I wasn't there. I'm trusting that Ken's account is correct on that one. I have no reason to suspect it's not. And I've seen the material from the Library of Congress. It was, in fact, put there in 1990, and there it resides to this day as a part of a public archive. Okay, now we get on to one of the most important lines in the notes, I think. 23B N1. Which really talks deeply about the process of scribing and where these words on these pages came from. Deborah, I'm going to hand it to you. T1B23BN1.
Okay, I dropped it and picked it up again. And just before I go on to there, I'm just going to make a comment, a brief comment here. I'm always very surprised as I've heard other students remark on, and I'm sure this is across the board with any students. What shows up when I can go over material and over material and over material, and something else just comes up off the page at me every time. Even this morning, reading this thing, and then suddenly something just rises from the page at me just now, which is, only the creations of light are real. I think that's such a real guide right there, that little wee statement, only the creations of light are real. So what are the creations of light? What is it that is full of light? And that's what's real. So when we're seeing light, we see that, so it's very awesome. Only the creations of light are real. Yeah, Doug just posted it on the board there. So I just wanted to shine light on that little sentence again. 23B-N1. As long as you take accurate notes, every word is meaningful. But I can't always get through. Whenever possible, I will correct retroactively. Be sure to note all later corrections. This means that you are more receptive than you were when I tried before. Doug, here's the mic.
Much speculation has taken place since the course first showed up in the world in 1975, or 76, as a mass-produced book, as to where these words came from and how many are Helen's. Was Helen writing in her own words, notions that came to her wordlessly? Was she simply inspired? Or was every word dictated by some supernatural entity? And opinions have varied widely. Here we have the voice itself, who has already, as Helen put it, unambiguously identified himself as the historical Jesus of Nazareth, saying, every word is meaningful, as long as you take accurate notes. In other words, as long as they're actually the words I gave you. And I recently, just last week, came across a little book by Mary Bruce Wallace, which is now on my website on the 2008 intro page at the bottom. And Mary Bruce Wallace scribed material from a voice beginning, I believe, in 1907 through to 1919. And what struck me as incredibly interesting about it was that so many of the concepts, and even a good portion of the language, is identical to that in A Course in Miracles. And if I hadn't known, I mean, if the book I was reading didn't have a publication date of 1918, I would have sworn the author of this material had to have been familiar with the Course. The ideas are just too similar, even the words used are often the same. And it certainly seems highly probable to me that Mary Bruce Wallace was in touch with the same thought system, at least, as Helen Shipman was in touch with. Otherwise, how could she, in 1914, 1907, have come up with such similar wording? And she describes her experience with her voice in terms very similar to those Helen Shipman used. Helen Shipman said it wasn't in her ear, it wasn't a vibration, it wasn't a sound. She used the term inner dictation, that the words came to her. Mary Bruce Wallace says, I didn't hear with my ears, I heard with my soul. And every word was given to me, and then the voice waited to make sure I got it down right, and then gave me the next word. And I had no idea what the next word would be. It sounds like a fairly slow process, but the way she did it was similar to the way Helen and Bill did it, so different. She heard in her soul the word, spoke it aloud, and her husband took it down in shorthand, and then later typed it up. In Helen's case, she heard with her soul, or received this inner dictation, wrote it down, often in shorthand, and later dictated it to Bill, who types it up. In each case, we have a collaborative operation, a collaborative effort between two people, and every word is specifically given with the scribe often not understanding the material until it's written down, not knowing what word's coming next. So clearly being unable to participate in the process of composition or edit on the fly. Because until the sentence is finished, how can you edit it? You know, until you know what was said, but once it's said, it's already down on paper. And from the physical record of Helen's shorthand notebooks, we see that what went down on paper, you know, we can see where she went back and changed it and where she didn't. Later, in the retyping and the multiple retypings that took place with the course, a great deal got changed. But in that original transcription, where she was hearing and writing as she heard, she had very little opportunity to participate in the process of selecting what the next word was going to be. And I think that Mary Bruce Wallace's description and Helen's correspond very closely, and they can probably help us understand exactly what was going on for both women who received comparably remarkable material, a thought system that neither was really familiar with, though both were familiar with the Bible, a voice which used their understanding of the Bible, biblical concepts and biblical quotes extensively, in making its case and presenting the information. But key here, I think, is every word is meaningful. These aren't Helen's words, though the words that would be used would be words Helen would know. So the voice is using Helen's vocabulary, Helen's language, which is English. He's not speaking in Hebrew. He's speaking in a language she knows and using words she knows, but he's choosing the words, not her, from her vocabulary. And earlier he talks about using Bill's language as well as her own. He sometimes uses words Bill knows and she doesn't. And now we come to this bit, but I can't always get through, which means that sometimes Helen isn't a clear channel. So wherever possible, I will correct retroactively. Be sure to note all later corrections. This means that you were more receptive than you were when I tried before. So sometimes the words are given and Helen's not getting them straight, at which point we do see in her note-taking that things come out in a way that later Jesus will actually, in some cases, twice, ask her to go back and change. So in that sense, when Helen's blocking, what comes out is not correct. So some words, therefore, are her own. And how do we tell the difference? Well, that's an interesting question. But where she's taking it straight, where she's getting it right, every word is Jesus. Where she's not, she's interfering. And there are points of both. And I'm going to hand the mic back to Deborah here on that one. And I see Teddy has made a comment, which I'm going to read. Here you go, Deb.
Christian, you had your hand up a couple of times. Did you want to take the mic? I'll open it here if you would like to take it. Okay, here you go. Maybe you're having problems grabbing it. Unless you think you have it, you don't. Try again.
Yes, my computer was just slow, Deborah. It's sometimes slow, so if that happens another time, if you just allow me a couple more seconds, the microphone symbol will appear. It actually varies the amount of time. Sometimes it's slow, sometimes it's not. So thanks. Well, I was guided to say yes, but actually there was a number of things coming into my mind when you were talking, Doug, so I'm just going to ask what, if anything, to say, because having had a number of things to say and not an opportunity to say them, I don't know which one I was guided to say yes about. So what I'm hearing is talk in symbols, and I can't see the board, by the way, because I can't possibly listen to the Holy Spirit and read the board and questions and so forth. Talk in symbols is really the language of the one dreamer. And so words are one form of symbol, but they're twice removed because the form of symbol that is once removed, you could say, is people and houses and so forth. Whereas words represent people and houses and so forth, so they are symbols of the symbols. So the language of the dreamer is the symbols of his dream. And that's the language in which he's talking and in which he's dreaming. And so it's useful to talk about the use of words through Helen and the revision of words through Helen, because we could take that back a step and say, we could talk about the use of the symbols through the dreamer, for example, they're being helpful in the idea that all events, circumstances, encounters and things are helpful. And so the dreamer is dreaming a helpful dream all the time. And in terms of revision, which you mentioned a couple of times, in terms such as Helen had to go back and make a revision to the phrase or sentence, and was asked to do that by Jesus. So the dreamer really is doing a revision in the atonement exercise. He's simply correcting all the errors of his dream until they're undone, and that is the meaning of the Last Judgment. When the dreamer recognizes the last of his creations, or you might call them, strictly speaking, miscreations, as benign, such as helpful circumstances, helpful things. And the light of understanding is recognized that he's never separated from God, and that's why it is all helpful. Then he will have a full revision of his dream, and alleluia, and he will be happy. And that dreamer is one amongst us. There is only one dreamer. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Christian. The question of the words is often comes up, and the way I have tried to understand it myself, I imagine, for instance, putting myself in the academic environment that Helen and Bill were in, and I attend a lecture, and the professor speaks. And there's two things I can do. If I'm good at shorthand, I can write down verbatim what the lecturer said and read his lecture later, if I wish. Or I can remember what the lecturer said and write down what I recall of what he said. In the first case, you can say, if the transcription was accurate, if the note-taking was correct, that the words are those of the lecturer, they're not mine. I was simply a dictation machine encoding his words on paper for him, in essence. In the second case, it's clearly my understanding of what I perceived him to have said, and while there may be some accurate quotes, there probably will be some inaccurate quotes and some misunderstandings, and it will be less than completely his words. It will be my report on his words. And the question then is, what is the Course in Miracles? Is it Helen's report on an experience or understanding that she obtained? Or was she, what Jesus called her, a scribe, a stenographer in essence, taking down his words for him? And so are these words her report or what he really said? That's how I tended to phrase the question for myself, because I'd like to know. And it certainly seems to me that except for places where she made mistakes, and we see that he goes back and tells her what to change when she made mistakes, the words are in fact his. Every word is meaningful. In other places, he tells us every word is carefully chosen. It's not loosey-goosey, reckless, careless, casual, but carefully chosen and meaningful, which is one reason why it's, I view it as important to get the words right. Is this really what he said, or is that what somebody thought he said? Or is that what what someone later thought he should have said but didn't say? Doesn't necessarily define which one's right or which one's wrong, but it can be useful to know what he actually said, especially if he views every word as meaningful. How you see Helen depends on how you see yourself. How you see anything depends on how you see yourself. Yes. And the hockey game is on, yes, the Olympic final. I think this is the gold medal match, which is probably why our audience is so small today. I'd be watching it if I weren't here. Okay. Where are we here now? Miracles are my second favorite line in all the course. An interlocking chain of forgiveness. T1B23C. Deborah. Wow. We're getting into the good stuff now. Take it away.
Yeah, we are getting into more good stuff. I'm just going to, hi, David, I'm going to post the link here of where we're picking up on reading, and that link is clickable. And Christian, what you're saying, I'm getting, he chose Helen as she was peaceful. I was thinking about that, what is this feeling around Helen? I was thinking about that earlier, and there is an amazing peaceful feeling around coming from that lady, and yet she has all of this ego chaos going on for herself, but that peacefulness is so potent, so strong with her. And I have to agree that on that point. Thanks for bringing that. Thanks for saying that, because it puts the words to what I was feeling. Oh, really? It just came to you. That's really neat. Thanks. Okay, so I'm going to carry on reading here. Miracles are a part of an interlocking chain of forgiveness, which, when completed, is the atonement. The process works all the time and in all dimensions of time. For example, this is in parentheses, given of Helen Schuckman, report rewrite for Esther. Esther had hurt something you loved. By writing a report you regarded as very bad, you atoned for her by writing one in her name that was very good. Actually, it was not your responsibility professionally to do this, but because you do love the shield, you recognize that in this case, you are your brother's keeper. Well, you did not cancel Esther's sin, parentheses, later defined as lack of love, close parentheses. You did cancel out its effects. Wow, did you want the mic here, Doug? Read on for more. You no hand up. I'm reading on 20. There's your hand.
Okay, I was reading some of the comments on the board here. Yeah, he chose Helen. Speaking to the comments here, and I'll read them for those on the radio. Christian was saying that he chose Helen because she was peaceful. That's not an opinion or experience. It just came to me, Christian writes. And Liz writes, I think Helen had peaceful, holy instants to beat the band, but she flickered quite a bit, too. She had her moments of flickering and struggle with the material, that's for sure. Carmen writes, yes, and Bill Fetford also. And I think that that's really important to remember. And as we look at some of the early documentation, Bill's role is obviously far more central than he was later to report it. He tended to be something of a self-effacing fellow and actually characterized himself as Helen's secretary, typing up her notes for him, whereas the author describes it as Bill's course, and Helen's role is assigned explicitly as helping Bill get the words right. And it was clearly the collaboration between the two, as they both understood and later acknowledged, their agreement together, wherever two or more are gathered together in my name, they were gathered together to find a better way. And that shared will, that agreement to join and collaborate in the enterprise, enabled it to happen because each of them brought capabilities, talents, and willingness and commitment that the other lacked. Bill couldn't hear the voice clearly, and I said this earlier. Helen could at times, but not without Bill holding her hand. Neither of them could have done this on their own. And she said she came to help Bill, and she's told that her role is to help Bill in the Ur text, and she complains about it bitterly. Bill should be helping me. I don't want to help him. And Jesus responds, Bill helps you all the time. And she kind of gets it and accepts it. And while she rebelled against her role, she clearly, as she said later, and I think this is probably true, it never occurred to her that she would abandon it or walk away from the project. Much as it was sometimes uncomfortable and difficult for her, she accepted it and could, what psychologists might call, distantiate enough from her own inner turmoils and difficulties to actually tune in to Jesus' voice and get it down right. Sometimes while riding in a cab, sometimes at work between phone calls, she'd take down a few more words. And you can sometimes see in the shorthand notes when she's in a cab, because in a vibrating automobile running over New York streets, and you know the way New York cabbies drive, well, maybe you don't. The way New York cabbies drive can cause me nervous conniptions riding in those cabs. The handwriting gets very shaky because it's difficult to write while riding in any car, let alone a New York cab. That topic. Now, back to 23C. Miracles are part of an interlocking chain of forgiveness. Now, that's a fantastic metaphor. Which, when completed, is the atonement, or the reconciliation, the restoration. So it's a chain of forgiveness, an interlocking chain of forgiveness, for which miracles are essential, or are a part. And this process works all the time and in all dimensions of time. And then Jesus gives an example of a colleague of Helen's named Esther. Esther had written a bad report. Helen rewrote it for her, which she was not professionally responsible to do. But she did it because of her love for the SHIELD project. And I'm not quite sure what the SHIELD project was, but it was some project Helen and Esther were both involved with. And this didn't cancel Esther's sin, later defined as lack of love, that led to the bad report, but it did cancel out its effects, demonstrating one of the interlocking chains of forgiveness, an advance towards atonement. The problem was corrected by Helen's act of love, by stepping in where she didn't need to and wasn't obligated to, out of love, to help a colleague who had stumbled in the moment or was lacking love, and the effect of that stumble was therefore canceled. Beautiful. Okay, now, I'm trying to read the board, too, and I'm going to do this thing of handing... Oh, Christian, you've got your hand up. So, we've got 13 minutes left, just to remind people that we're on a schedule here, and here's the mic.
Actually, that kind of reminds me, atoning for a stumble sounds exactly like the words in the teacher's manual. That say that two people can know each other for life and they may remain hostile, but if they can learn the lesson before them, they become the teachers of teachers and help them when they stumble, or whatever the wording is. I had an experience recently where I seemed to be guided to round up a teacher of God who I was told was falling away from his function. And in truth, although I've had certain dealings with the person, I really don't know what it's about. But it's interesting that I didn't know, I was not aware that Helen was guided to help Bill. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you for that participation. So, Carmen, are you saying that the SHIELD report, SHIELD refers to a newsletter about what, child psychology? Is that what your comment meant there? Yeah. Okay. I want to talk to you about that later because I had not been able to track down what that referred to. Okay, so the cancellation of lack of love or a mistake through an act of love is a miraculous part of an interlocking chain of forgiveness, which, when completed, is the atonement. So when we're told we need to accept the atonement for ourselves and that's all we need to do, that means accepting the interlocking chain of forgiveness through forgiveness, which implies miracle mindedness. Atonement becomes a very large word in A Course in Miracles. And I think we can go for at least one more paragraph. And this pretty much concludes this segment here. So I think we might end at this and wrap things up after this paragraph, unless something else happens. T1B23D. Deborah.
Someday I want to tell Esther that not only is she forgiven, but that the effects of all her sins are canceled. This is what I have already told you. When I can tell her, she will be afraid for a long time because she will remember many things consciously or unconsciously, including the SHIELD report, a lack of love which you canceled out in advance by a miracle of devotion. I should go on a little bit, Doug, you think? There's 10 minutes. I'll carry on until you grab the mic. 23E. Oh, you're going to grab the mic. Here you go.
Yeah, actually, although the foundation version sticks in a section break here, I think the next two paragraphs really appropriately belong with that one. So, yeah, carry on the next two.
Okay, 23E. I am in charge of the process of atonement, which I undertook to begin. My atonement was for the canceling out of all sins, in effect, lack of love, in parentheses, which human beings could not otherwise correct. That is what the biblical statement, underneath are the everlasting arms, means. Thank you. Says me. 23E-N1. Doug, do you want the mic now, or I'll give it to you?
Yeah, this is a profoundly significant little paragraph for a Christian theologian, or probably almost any Christian. The idea that Jesus canceled out all sins is a basic Christian doctrinal statement, and in most denominations, that's understood to mean that his death on the cross was a payment for all of our sins. In that basic Christology, Jesus was killed and punished because we were bad, and he accepted the punishment on our behalf as a substitution. Now, many points in the course, that kind of Christology is flatly contradicted. And the idea that God killed his son because we were bad, Jesus, the course, dumps that notion. But the idea of atonement here is being removed from the idea of paying for or being punished for a lack of love and shifted into a correction for a lack of love, which restores love. No punishment required. No guilt associated with lack of love. Simply a mistake that gets fixed. But that human beings could not correct without Jesus' help. And then we're told that's what the biblical statement underneath are the everlasting arms means. Elsewhere, this is described as, in Helen's words, as Jesus acting as a backstop in case we fail. And Jesus is also saying here, I am in charge of the process which I undertook to begin. And that's a very, very, very significant statement about authority and the whole authority problem. Who's in charge here? Me or him? Can I undo the effects of my own lack of love? Can I fix my own mistakes? And I'm being told here, no. And if I replace human beings with my own name, Jesus is saying, I, Jesus, am in charge of the process of atonement which I undertook to begin. My atonement was for the canceling out of all sins or lack of love, which you, Doug, could not otherwise correct. That's what the biblical statement underneath are the everlasting arms means. This is the beginning of Jesus redrawing classical Christian Christology. What does Christ mean? What does canceling out sin mean? What does sin mean? What does atonement mean? And what does the love of God mean? And looking at the board here, I see... What do I see? Did somebody say something about the hockey game? Oh, the hockey game! Oh, Canada won. Well, inevitable, eh? All right. We've got 5 minutes left, and I'm going to suggest we stop here. And, well, we had to win. It was in Vancouver, after all, right? It would have just been... It would have been an insult to the national ego. The Canadian team hadn't taken a gold medal in the national sport, so which occasionally happens, but not very often. We have had some remarkable material covered today, and the key of the many significant points that have been raised, I think the key one I want to stress is atonement. And the beginning, Jesus begins in this segment we've covered today, to redefine atonement from punishment as payment for guilt and sin into correction of error that restores breached relationships or the illusion of separation between brothers, such that unity, oneness, and love flows where it had been interrupted by our misperceptions. Completely stepping out of the concept of sin and punishment, but only very indirectly so far. We will get much more direct in coming weeks, in coming pages of this material. He's beginning to introduce this concept to Helen and Bill, who presumably at this point understand atonement and guilt and sin the way our culture generally does. And he's giving them, bit by bit, with direct personal examples, a new way of understanding this concept, which will be elaborated greatly. He's also introduced the idea of forgiveness, that forgiveness is key to the atonement. And that also will be expanded vastly as we move through this material. All right. I would like to thank everybody who's been here and everybody who has participated, and all you on the radio who've been with us in spirit, if not on our board. And next week, we'll pick up from this point and carry on. Hopefully this evening, if not tomorrow, hopefully, if I manage to get a successful recording of this session, it'll be on the website, www.miraclesinactionpress.com, under the category